Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
So, Guy, Nick Mason's Source Full of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Control Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason's Source Full of Secrets.
You did, and in fact, that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's His U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So, join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon, and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever heard, frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Source Full of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. God, it's been a while, hasn't it?
It has been a while. It's been so nice to just not have to see you.
I forced myself on you a couple of times and I actually came to your house.
You did come to my house. Yes, we're still burning sage. And I came to your house, of course, over Christmas.
My annual party, Christmas do. Do you know what I have to say? I'll say this now. I was speaking to Mr. Townsend at my party, who said, "Do you know what the thing is with Guy?" He said, "You think you've got the bass nailed on your demo, and then Guy comes in and the bass goes up another notch and another notch." Because you played with him, didn't you?
I did play with him. It's very sweet. And actually, at your party, he said a very lovely thing to me. He said, "I did actually avoid working with you for years because you're just too much of a fan."
Well, that's true. And I think that's probably why he's not on this show.
That's true. He keeps knocking us back.
Yeah. And of course, you've actually played a bit with David Gilmour. I saw that on Instagram.
Yes, I was. Yeah, I can talk about this because thanks to Polly's Instagram feed. Yeah, I did a week working with David with Steve Gadd on drums.
Amazing. How was that?
Can I just say, Steve Gadd's bass drum just makes me want to cry.
Really?
It's just something about the way he puts it. And where
did you sit with it perfectly?
Oh, I like to think so.
How fabulous. So we've got all that to look forward to this year as well. Some more music.
We have. But hey, what a guest today.
Yeah, Tony James. Honestly, I mean, Generation X was such an inspiration, and I'll gas on about it later on when he's on. Such an inspiration to Spandau Ballet, to be honest. I mean, when we were the makers initially, and then later on in art design and just pop sensibility. I love Tony, but his story is quite long, isn't it? I mean, he's been around.
It is, yeah, a lot. But also because he is one of those great conceptualists. He's one, you know, he's very much the... He's not someone I think about as a bass player. He's just one of those people who's a linchpin of great ideas-based projects.
Yeah. So he's right at the beginning of punk with London SS, then Generation X, and then later on, of course, Zig Zig Sputnik, and he plays with Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers. Sisters of Mercy he played with for a while. Now, of course, it's Generation Sex, which are enormous.
Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rockonteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune, for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them, and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you, guys, for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rockonteurs Podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Hello, Tony. I haven't seen you for years. We used to hang in the Groucho with Emma Cameron.
Exactly.
With
Emma when you were Cameron a young man just about to get married.
Oh, good Lord. Wow.
I think you were with Janet Street Porter at the time, probably, weren't you?
Probably, yes. Now, let me just get a bit more volume. Okay, I have to get into character.
Tony, it was great to see you. I saw you for breakfast the other week,
yeah.
and this is how this came about, because we hadn't seen each other for a while.
That's right.
Well, I know. I mean, I hope you don't mind. I'm going to say you're now 70.
Yes.
What is amazing is your life has sort of been directing itself just to this past couple of years, because these couple of years you're suddenly on private jets being flown around doing rock shows bigger than you've ever played before, and
sure.
and it's suddenly happened. That was a long gestation,
isn't it? It's strange, isn't it, the fact that me and Billy and Steve and Paul have all known each other for so many years, and that we even grew up in the same neighborhood. You know, Steve Jones and I were born in the same hospital in Shepherd's wow. Bush. Oh. And we all grew up in the same kind of terraced houses, toilet at the bottom of the garden, not to big up my credentials. Look how poor we were.
Well, hang on. Like... Well, sorry, we'll talk about Tony Parsons and the orange juice later. But...
yes. That was cruel. So, we've known each other all this time. So it was an extraordinary thing to play with Generation Sex and to go out and play those great songs last year. We had such a great time. Such fun for me to play the Pistol songs that I knew and had grown up with as well. So it was an amazing thing. I can say, after this whole arc of the story, to be doing better now than we've ever done in our career is a great time. I'm glad it's now, not it was then.
or in 10 years' time.
Yes, we will be in trouble then.
Generation 80. But whose idea was Generation Sex?
My wife had said she wanted to go to America, and we decided to rent a house on the beach in Malibu. This is in 2018. And we went out, and part of the reason was to hook up with Billy and to talk about they were re-releasing some of the old Generation X product. And we'd always talked about getting back together again as Generation X, as the original band. So we met up at Chateau Marmont one day, and Billy and I, it was as if, I'm sure you find it with your bandmates, as if you've never been away.
You've never left port.
Yes. See, you got all the funny lines. So Billy said, what are you doing on, tomorrow? Because do you want to go and see you too with me? And I said, yeah, not thinking how long it takes to get from Malibu to Beverly Hills back to where you two were playing. This is like a 4-hour round trip.
Everything in LA is, yeah.
Forget how long everything takes. Yeah. Anyway, we finally arrive at the U2 gig, and we go through more and more security, getting from the big backstage area to the VIP area to the VVIP area. And we finally burst into a tiny room, which is about as big as my living room. And the first person I see is Brad Pitt. And then I see Steve Jones standing there, who comes up, gives me a giant bear hug. And he went, you know what, Tone? If you do Generation X, use me as a guitarist. And I sort of went, and I looked at Billy, and I turned around, and Steve had vanished. So it was as if he kind of said, why don't we do this? Because you know what it's like when you're doing things with groups? No one wants to kind of lose face or be the one who actually says, what about doing this? In case the other person goes, oh, fuck off, don't be ridiculous. So it's almost like Steve kind of blurted out the unsayable. Because obviously, back in the day when we recorded Dance With Myself, we did it with Steve Jones. He was the guitarist on that record. So there was a kind of a history and a precedent.
Because didn't Steve then sort of, it was sort of announced when you and Billy went on Jones's Jukebox?
That's right. So he texted me the next day and went, why don't you and Billy come on the show? And we met in the green room for about 2 minutes before we went live on the air. And Steve went, so why don't we do this? And he went, I'll give Cookie a ring. And Billy went, yeah, it'd be great. So we went on the air and it was kind of a done deal where there was no real discussion. But it's one of those moments where you think it's meant to be.
Who came up with the name, the idea?
Steve said, oh, I think we should call it Generation Sex. You know, otherwise it would have been, what else was it? X Pistols, you know, the
Sex
Pistols. Yeah. So Generation Sex, you know, sounded good because it sort of rolls off the tongue and, you know, looks great on merchandise.
So did you get into rehearsals in LA or what happened? And how did you use the set list?
We said, let's all do it. And then it took like a while, maybe a year or so, to kind of get it together. And Paul and I flew out to Los Angeles and we rehearsed for a week in Los Angeles. And then we did one kind of secret show that they just announced on the radio, perfectly at the club called the Roxy Club in LA. And we did one show just to see how it would go and see if it worked. And of course, it was so great and we were all dying to do it. And we were set to tour almost straight away. But then Steve had some problems with his heart that's been widely talked about. So we had to kind of put it back for a couple of years. So anyway, last year, we finally got it together. And Steve flew over and we rehearsed in Shepherd's Bush, very fitting, where we were all born.
Where in Shepherd's Bush, out of interest?
That one under the arches. Where where the crack dealers live. There was us and Metallica were rehearsing in the studio next door. Even though ours was bigger, I have to say.
And how was everyone's chops?
Great. I mean, it's just, you know, Steve sort of gets up and he plugs in and it sounds like Steve Jones. It's just great. And Billy had learned all his parts. Paul and I were totally note perfect because I'd rehearsed loads and loads at home to make sure I knew. Because also it was really hard to learn to play that fast again. You forgot how fast the Generation X stuff was. The pistol stuff is all quite mid-pace.
I remember an interview with you years and years and years ago, sorry to interrupt, but you saying how shocked you were when you first heard the Pistols records because how slow they were.
That's right.
Because everyone was doing this Ramones thing. And then I remember, because your quote was great. You said, and suddenly they come out and they're like, who speed?
Yes. Yeah. Well, they're like Small Faces speed. Yeah. That was what it was. And so playing their stuff for me is easy. But I tell you what, it's when you plug in and Steve and Paul play and Billy's singing, it just sounds massive because Steve has that sound.
Yeah, you told me this the other day, which I didn't know. This is a bass player thing, Guy. But do you know, I mean, obviously Tony plays with a pick. So, I mean, Glenn doesn't. But Tony ever plays upstrokes.
Upstrokes. I did know that. Yeah. And it's
much harder. I don't know why.
So much harder. So much harder. What the hell are you thinking?
I know. Well, I must have started.
And a Rickenbacker. You play a Rickenbacker, right?
I mean, yes. I must have started when I was at school. Practicing in my bedroom on a little bass guitar that I'd actually made at the time. And I must have just started playing all upstrokes. You know, you didn't have YouTube then. You had a bit of Top of the Pops, but I had no idea that I was doing it wrong. But as it turns out, you get a better sound by pulling upstrokes because you're pulling those strings towards you. So you get a much more...
Yeah,
thumping,
I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Powerful sound.
Yeah, Tony, but like yourself, you had nothing. This lot, they all had play in a day. We didn't even have that.
Right. Tony, did you have trouble masturbating as well?
No, he was very, very good at it. I think
only upstrokes. This isn't going to work, surely.
I thought I'd broken it the first time.
Who decided you weren't going to do Anarchy in the UK though?
I think. Billy, all of us felt uncomfortable because it's so John's song and so his whole persona. It seemed not right for us to do it. When we first did the gigs, we mainly did material off the Swindle record. And we did the Ronnie Biggs track, you know, which this time we did.
Friggin' in the Rigging and all that.
No, we didn't do that one. But this time we decided, you know, we can't consciously get behind the lyric of that song. You know, at our age. But then we gradually introduced the more obvious Pistols classics like Bodies, and we're going to do Holidays in the Sun as well now. So, you know, all the really great ones. How great is it to come on and open with Pretty Vacant? If you're a football team, you're 2-0 up before you even walk on the pitch.
Is it a bit uncomfortable singing Holidays in the Sun, though? You know, in those days, in the 70s, you know, people, you know, in the crowd wearing swastikas as well. We're living in different times now.
It's totally different now. You don't get any of that stuff.
No, I don't mean that. I just mean the lyrics of Holiday.
Yes, might be a little on point for now.
I don't know. I mean,
we did make an adjustment of some of the lyrics of tracks that made them more appropriate for now. You know, well, stuff that we felt uncomfortable singing now.
Yeah.
Often, don't you find that, you know, stuff you wrote when you were 18, 20, you have this whole different view of the world. And now perhaps we're a little bit more sophisticated or a little bit more conscious of people listening to those words. So,
yeah.
Well, you know, punk lyrics were very much about youth, weren't they? I mean, you know, it's a bit like The Who singing My Generation. They still manage that. And you guys singing Your Generation. I guess that works, though, doesn't it? Your Generation.
Yeah, because it's such a... The whole thing about all those songs is they're great tunes.
Great tunes. Do you do Kiss Me Deadly?
Kiss Me Deadly, all that. I love that stuff.
Exactly. Doing those ones.
And what about Billy's solo stuff? Do you do any of that?
We made a conscious decision not to do any of our solo stuff. I actually learned a load of Billy's tracks as well, just in case. And sometimes in the sound check, we just chuck stuff in. But it's really just to say, here is a combination of these two great groups, two great dynasties, and we play the sort of greatest hits of both. So I think it would muddy the water if we started throwing in Love Missile or White Wedding or, you know, Joint Professionals or whatever. You could do. The temptation is there because they're all such winners.
But then you need more of a palette, don't you? I mean, especially if you're doing Sieg stuff, then you need to get into...
That's right. So, you know, Love Missile F111 is exactly the same speed as Dancing With Myself. And in fact, when we used to do the Zig Zig gigs, we used to go into Dancing With Myself at the end of Love Missile.
Oh, amazing.
So, because they're both at 192 BPM, so they fit together perfectly, and they're both in the same key.
Notting Hill.
Yes. For those who don't know, there was a famous restaurant in Notting Hill Gate called 192, where you obviously wrote the song.
That is very funny. I know, it is at 192. Yes.
Okay, so what was the biggest gig you've done so far as Generation Sex? What was the one that blew your mind and thought, this is it now?
I think when we played in Paris at the Stade de Paris, which is like 70,000 indoors, it's huge. And when we were doing My Way at the end of the set, literally everyone was on their feet singing along to the track and clapping along to it. And it's an extraordinary thing. And you see yourself on these massive video screens.
Does Billy shoot the audience at the end?
That was extraordinary. Some of the best ones, though, were in places like the halls at Wolverhampton or the Apollo in Manchester, where you're looking at, you know, 3,500, 4,000 or something like that, where it's more sort of intimate. And that was so great because there you could hear everyone singing literally every word of every track.
And what are the audience like?
Punks, young punks, old punks.
Fantastic.
Why a selection.
What did Steve think of Pistol, the TV show? Was he happy with it, where it came out? Because it was based on his book, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was... I said to Danny Boyle when I met him that I really enjoyed it, and I thought it put across the vibe of the time. Of course, there were certain inaccuracies, and I think it was a bit over cruel to Glenn, which was a bit unfair, but I guess they put that in for the drama of it. And that's always going to happen in someone's personal life. But I thought overall it came across really well and put the feeling and an excitement of the time.
No, you saw Chrissie Hynde the other day, didn't you?
And do you know what? What's really annoying is I forgot to ask her about it because she features so heavily. Yes. No, but do you know what was one of the sweetest things was seeing Chrissie the other day, which showed that she still has this thing from when she was a kid, that she was such a Beatles fan, she can still do all of their signatures perfectly.
My God, so someone's probably spent 100,000...
Fortunes.
Exactly. On Chrissie Hynde's George Harrison.
Interestingly, There's a tape in existence, which we've never released, of London SS, which we'll get to another time.
Yes.
And there's actually a recording.
Oh, another time.
At the front of the tape, someone in the room says, "You realise everything you're saying about Chrissie Hynde is going on to tape." So we obviously were friends and hanging out at that time with her. And that sort of opens the recording.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's a piece of valuable social history, it feels like. First time
that's also actually a fantastic opening to an album.
Yes. And the first track we did was Rambling Rose, which, of course, you know, the MC5 track, which is sad because obviously he died.
Yeah, he just died. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so let's go back to your roots.
Yes.
You know, we have to do this.
Yes.
Because
I'll try not to interrupt you. I talk too much.
We interrupt.
No, you don't.
That's all we do. We were going to call this podcast, you know, The Interrupters, but that's what we do. Don't worry about it, Tony. But
okay.
What was your, because you're about 6 years older or something, 7 or 8 years older than us two. What was your sort of first thing that turned you on?
Well, I grew up in a place called Strawberry Hill, which is between Twickenham and Teddington, just on the river at Twickenham. And my life changed the day we went and saw our first group. And my friend at school said, "Oh, there's this group called Deep Purple playing round the corner in this club called Eel Pie Island," which obviously is a very famous legendary club. And
I would have thought it was gone by that time.
No, it reopened as Colonel Barefoot's Rock Garden.
Right.
And I was at Hampton Grammar School, and I could walk to Eel Pie Island from my house. So on a Friday evening, we walked to Eel Pie Island, and I paid my money and queued up. And I saw Deep Purple. That was the first sort of rock group I'd seen.
How old are you here?
Must have been 16 or something like that.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, and that was the changed moment of my life. See, I think there's a thing with musicians that when I saw that first group, I loved it, and I was totally freaked by how loud it was and how exciting it was. But in that moment, I knew it. I wanted to be the person on stage, mm-hmm. not person being a fan. And that's often the difference that makes people become musicians. You want to do it when you see it. It inspires you to be it yourself. Yeah. Obviously, I never for a second thought we could ever reach the heights of playing in a little club with a real group, with real 2 cabinet amplifiers and high watt stacks and things. But that was the moment it all started. And then the next week, I think we saw Black Sabbath and Free and Taste with Rory Gallagher. And wow. So it was that English blues rock boom, which kind of formed my start in rock and roll. And then, of course, we loved all the English counterculture groups, Hawkwind and the Pink Fairies especially, and the Edgar Broughton Band. We travelled all round to go and see these groups. Where we lived in Strawberry Hill, there was a college called St Mary's at the end of my road, literally 100 yards from my front door. And one of the next group that I saw was the Pink Floyd playing at St Mary's College in Strawberry Hill.
What year is this? So what are Pink Floyd doing at this point?
Saucer Full of Secrets.
Oh, my God.
Period.
So,
what
so
we do
with David. Controls the Heart of the Sun.
This was with David, not
yes, David. Yeah. These were all the groups that changed everything. It's funny, during the whole punk movement, I sort of edited it out in my head because there was that No Elvis, Beatles, Rolling Stones in 1977 kind of catchphrase. It was as if we all edited out the fact that we actually all really liked Elvis, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and they were some of the main groups that informed us.
Well, but you actually wrote that came out in one of the songs. I think it was in Ready, Steady, Go.
It was a clash.
It was a clash who said that.
No, not that. You're in Ready, Steady, Go. It actually says
I'm in love with those groups.
I'm in love with those groups.
I was going to say, this is the difference between... this is further on because there's something I want to say about how Generation X were different.
Yes.
To the other punk bands, but we're not there yet.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So I'm going to Eel Pie Island, seeing groups regularly, you know, following Hawkwind, Pink Fairies, seeing them play Under the Westway. Loved him in that band. And of course, the 2 drummers thing was something I really loved. And then I needed to get a bass buy a bass guitar. Or
now, why bass guitar? Why did you choose bass guitar?
I think at school it was one of those things where someone already played drums.
yeah.
Or played that, guitar.
Always the case.
And it's like, well, I'll get a bass. I was sort of saving up for my first cheap bass, and so there was a big house at the bottom of our garden. We lived in a kind of a semi-detached row of houses, and at the bottom of the garden was a big house, like a big old Victorian mansion. And I started babysitting, this is a funny story, for the people who lived in the big house at the bottom of our garden. Well, it turns out the man who owned the big house, who I babysitted for, was a man called Neil Aspinall.
Oh,
Beatles road manager, and who at that time ran Apple Records.
Yeah, wow.
And so when I bought my first amplifier, he let me rehearse in the basement of his big house. So I had my equipment, so I used to practice. And it seemed like totally normal and not a big deal. But obviously you look back at it now and you think, fuck.
I also like the fact that Neil Aspinall went to the estate agent and went, have you got anything like Strawberry Fields that I can live in?
Yeah, that's right. So can you imagine as like a, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-old, I'm sitting there at night babysitting, sitting there with a bass guitar on my lap, and they bring people back for drinks after their night out. And I'm suddenly sitting on the sofa with George Harrison and Keith Moon.
Oh, my God.
And they're going, oh, so you want to be in a group, do you? Well, you know, you should learn the classics. That's what we did.
That's amazing.
Then you think it's totally normal.
Yeah.
And years later, when Billy and I were offered our first management contract, someone gave us a management contract and we're going, bloody hell, what do we do with this? And I went, oh, I know this bloke. I bet he knows a bit about it. And Billy and I took the management contract to Apple Records and we sat in Neil Aspinall's office in Apple with our management contract. And Neil was just in one of those periods where they spent millions and millions of dollars with lawyers fighting, you know, all those deals the Beatles wanted to get out of. And he looked at it and he went, don't ever sign this. And we didn't. So maybe he really...
Who was that with? Was that Bernie Rhodes?
No. No, pre-Bernie. That's a, you know, then we get on to the next chapters. So I had a group when I was at school that was like a counterculture type group. And it was called Sun, spelled S-U-U-N. And I've actually got tapes of that as well. And we used to... We played gigs.
That's now an IKEA bookcase, isn't it?
Probably. Yeah. We used to rehearse. We used to play gigs at the local squat in Twickenham. Sorry. So they took over this old hotel, and we actually played at the Windsor Free Festival as well. And we had two drummers, bass. And
fantastic.
So it was a sort of a bit of a Hawkwind Pink Fairies copy.
Yeah, so you took that idea onto C6 Sputnik, didn't you?
Yes, later. Sputnik was a kind of futuristic version of that. I mean, when I look back at the songs, it's pathetic copies of everybody else's stuff. But that was the initial thing.
When was the moment, I'm guessing, that you sort of started looking to New York for your inspiration?
That came later. I'll tell you what happened. It was that I suppose there were two things when I think about it that had this group, and then we'd started to go a bit further afield because a friend of mine at school had a car, and we used to go to gigs across London and, you know, Yale Technical College, and Fulham Greyhound was one of our main places that we used to go to because it was free. And we used to go and see all these groups there. And that was the next thing that changed, because I had this sort of space rock Pink Fairies counterculture group, but I'd also bought a book by Mick Farren called The Tale of Willy's Rats. I don't know if you know of this book. It was about a kind of an English proto-punk group who grow up in Ladbroke Grove. And the other thing
is Mick Farren? Was he a musician?
He was an NME writer.
Who had that band, The Social Deviants, back in Middle Earth period.
With the guys from the Pink Fairies, pre-Pink Fairies. Yeah. And also, the other thing that I'd started to buy was from Compendium Books in Camden High Street. We used to go to Camden High Street and to the market on Sundays. They were imported an American magazine called Rock Scene that had all those American groups in, like the New York Dolls. And the New York Dolls were the other main group that I started to get into. So like the Ziggy Stardust. And the Dolls came along and it's like, wow, this is like exotic looking, arrogant Rolling Stones. Those were the things that were starting to go, oh, there could be something different than the kind of counterculture Labrador Grove scene. So, and then I a heavy metal kids gig at Fulham Greyhound.
Ah, with
Gary Holton.
Gary Holton, yeah.
Who was in Alvida Senpest.
But a fantastic kind of glam rock energy.
Front man, kind of the Artful Dodger as lead. And I went to the Fulham Greyhound and I met this other guy and he said, I'm playing in this group and we're rehearsing in Southwark. Why didn't you come down and see us? We were chatting in the bar and he was also reading The Tale of Willy's Rats at the same time. So we had this kind of connection. So that week I went down to see this group that he was rehearsing with. And when I got there, he was just coming out and he said, you're not going to believe this. I'm sacked. They fired me.
Oh, my God. Okay.
And we went, oh. And we sat on the tube on the Bakerloo line back to Maida Vale, the two of us. And we went, well, maybe we should do something. And that was Mick Jones. And that's how we met.
Mick Jones, he wasn't bald then.
No.
No, that's right. Yeah, being wavy hair, didn't he? And he played like an Explorer guitar or something.
Yeah, and he looked like a kind of an English Johnny Thunders.
Yeah,
because the other person was at that heavy metal kids gig that I didn't meet was Steve Jones, because he was going to the Fulham Greyhound at the same time as we were. So all these people were kind of gravitating, even though we didn't know that destiny was going to bring us.
Also, wasn't there that there's a T-shirt involved, isn't there? There's a the one day you're going to wake up and know what side of the bed you're on. So, was that later?
Yeah. Mick and I are talking about forming a group together. We have long hair. We look like a UK New York Dolls at this stage. And we start running adverts in the Melody Maker saying, wanted young singer, young guitarist, because we thought Mick would just be the rhythm guitarist. He didn't think, you know, whether he would be good enough to play lead guitar. And we started advertising Wanted into New York Dolls, Mott the Hoople, Small Faces, the kind of classic things that you would expect. Yeah. Must be skinny. It's
brilliant. Love that.
I've got all the adverts that we ran in the Melody Maker torn out of the Melody Maker.
Oh, brilliant. No beards.
No, well, that's the general kind of vibe.
No breadheads or time wasters.
Right. But the first person that replied to our advert was a bloke, and he said, I'm working in Belgium at the moment, but I'm coming back to the UK, and why don't I come down and, you know, have a play with you guys? And that was Brian James.
Who ended up in The Damned, yeah.
So the unfortunately titled London SS was three then. It was Brian James, me and Mick Jones. And a drummer called Roland Hott, who we'd met at some sort of pub rock gig, but we were looking for drummers at the time.
But there's no sense of punk at this time. There's no. You don't know. I mean, Malcolm's...
No Ramones. No. Only New York Dolls.
And Iggy. Can I just interrupt with one little point of pride here? So I just say that, you know, my first ever professional gig when I was probably 18 or just 19 was playing for Sylvain Sylvain.
Oh, really?
When he came along, yeah. I went to Europe with him and everything. So anyway.
Right. Well, and because years later, I ended up touring with Johnny Thunders, people, and Jerry, of playing with the two. But that's further down the...
So good they named him twice.
I'd read about this shop in the King's Road called Let It Rock, and I'd gone up there on a Saturday afternoon, and the only thing I could afford to buy from the shop was a T-shirt, which was the one of these days you're going to... wake up and know what side of the bed you're lying
on. So this is Malcolm and Vivian's shop, right?
Yes. Yeah. And this T-shirt, according to Bernie, was designed by Bernie. And it was really two halves on the T-shirt, the cool side and the non-cool side. But it was very hard to tell which was which unless you knew it were in the know.
How can one side be cool and one not? Is one bubble writing or something?
No. It was a list of artists and groups.
Writers.
And writers and things. At first sight, you might think, oh, they're cool as well, but they're sort of not cool or something.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at and it's just a nightmare. AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out. Are you saying, Tony, you were the first rock player to wear a McLaren Westwood?
I don't know if
piece.
I was the first one, because obviously, unbeknown to us, the nascent Pistols were recursing across town.
Right, okay.
And we hadn't met them yet.
Oh, okay. This is beautiful stuff.
We're doing our thing. And then we went to see Deaf School at the Nashville, which was one of those classic places. You know, I saw AC/DC.
A band who don't get the credit they deserve, I think.
Yeah. Langer. Yeah. Is it Clive Langer? Is it
Clive Langer? Yeah, it was Clive Langer.
Yeah. So we were standing watching Deaf School, and I was wearing all proudly my T-shirt. We've got long hair. And this little bloke in a hat and glasses comes up to us wearing the same T-shirt, right? So rather arrogantly, I said to him, "Oi, look, don't stand next to me in the same T-shirt. It's making me look bad here." And he went, "What are you fucking done? I designed that T-shirt. What do you know?" And it was Bernie Rhodes.
Right?
So we were talking to Bernie, and we said, "Oh, we've got this band called London SS." And he went, "Really? That's interesting." And that's how we hooked up with Bernie, and then became a year and a half or 2 years of Bernie making my life a total misery, but also a fantastic. This could take longer than an hour if I keep telling you. You want to hear the whole story?
Because obviously Mick Jones stayed with Bernie, didn't he?
Right, because he managed the Clash. But Bernie was going to be our manager, so Bernie said, "You need a place to rehearse," and he found this place. It was a basement in Parade Street in Paddington, and it was on the corner of Parade Street, Paddington Mews, and a street called, ironically, Star Street, was where this basement was. And Bernie set it up that we could rehearse, and he put all his records on the jukebox in the cafe, which was above the basement rehearsal, and that became our kind of two eyes hanging out place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we're doing our thing. So we've still got long hair. We're looking for a David Johansen to front the group. And we're putting adverts in the paper. And it's got Bernie's phone number in the adverts from then on.
Do any of those songs survive in other bands later?
I think Protex Brew that we'd... Clash did.
Are they already... Are they fast? Are they punk songs then?
They're MC5 speed.
Right. Ah, MC5.
We were listening to the MC5, that album Nuggets. We were playing Roadrunner. You know, Jonathan Richman was starting to filter through. We were doing bits of Dole's tracks, bits of fast Mott the Hoople tracks. But the Ramones hadn't come along yet. Remember, the Ramones was the total game changer, where when that album came out, all the punk groups doubled speed. So that was totally changed everything. So, but we're still doing our sort of New York Dolls thing. And there was at one stage where we went over and we went to the Pistols rehearsal rooms in Denmark Street where they were. And we walked in and we all had long hair and they all had short hair. And we sort of went, fuck, they've all got short hair. And suddenly there was this kind of thing where we suddenly felt it was kind of wrong, you know. We just spent all that time at school standing outside in maths lessons from having long hair because you weren't allowed in the classroom.
Yeah, yeah.
What about flares?
We definitely had flares and all those things. So we suddenly were realizing that there's something else going on.
Whose idea do you think it was to get your hair, to get their hair cut short? Steve ever told you that?
I think probably Malcolm and Bernie's. And then... We started rehearsing. We started auditioning people in this basement that Bernie had found us. And we put all movie posters on the wall, Horror of the Maniac and all these sort of horror film
B-movies.
B-movie, cult movies all around. And we needed microphones. And Bernie turned up one day with a load of all these microphones. And it was like, brilliant. They were really expensive microphones. And he went, yeah, I got them off. Steve Jones got them for us. Turns out, where did he get them? Ziggy's last gig.
Was it really? Is that true? Yeah. I've always doubted that because I thought it was Bob Marley that he stole some stuff from at the Rainbow.
And Roxy Music.
But it was Ziggy's last gig.
He obviously collected them over time, and we got them for our rehearsal studio. So now we've got a studio, we've got microphones, bit of a PA, and we start, you know, trying to write songs and auditioning people. Paul Simonon came down as a singer and did a very long, boring version of Roadrunner. I think he might mention it to you. Rats Gabies came down to audition as a drummer.
You named him Rats Gabies, did you? That was your idea.
He came down and he had fucking scabies. And Bernie was totally freaked out. Bernie spent the entire rehearsals putting newspapers on chairs in case he caught something off him. That night, there was this, at one stage, and it was quite a seedy place, there was this giant rat standing behind the drum kit, looking out. And we went, fuck me, rats and scabies. 4 days later, we're in the pub in Portobello Road, and he walks in with a black T-shirt with a drawing of a little rat on it, and he's calling himself Rat Scabies.
So that's
where that name came. So all these different people came through the sort of London SS rehearsal place, because you can imagine the scene is really, really tiny at that time. Yeah. There's the Pistols across town with their short hair. And we spent a lot of time with Malcolm and Bernie, them telling us what was going to happen and how you could change the music business and how that everything else would look old-fashioned.
And reading lists, right? Didn't Bernie give you...
Yes. I mean, this was an extraordinary thing that Bernie used to make, because Bernie's thing was always... Because now I lived in Strawberry Hill in Twickenham, in a more sort of affluent area. Bernie would always say, you're too fucking middle class and you go to grammar school. You're too middle class. You need to get more streetwise. So Bernie would give me reading lists, which I would take to Teddington Library, and I would come back with Jean-Paul Sartre books and books on art. And I dutifully
Nothing middle class about that.
Dutifully read all these books. But what I realised was, of course, it was genius what he did. Because rather than come along and say, this is what you need to sing about, this is what you need to be, he put us in an environment of creativity and the right influences and allowed us to come up with it ourselves. So it was very clever. His classic was one Christmas. He went, what are you doing for Christmas? And I went, well, staying at home with my mum and dad. You don't want to do that. You should spend Christmas with hookers. And also you've got to go out and buy spare rib and gay news in your local news agent.
Did you do that?
No. Did you spend Christmas with hookers?
No. I did chicken out of that bit. But you can see where he was coming from. Another classic was he took us in his, what we used to call the Bernie Mobile. He had this little car and he took us to Hamilton Terrace in Maida Vale.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There was a huge mansion and obviously a really extraordinary rock and roll party going on. And we could see people like the Rolling Stones going in. And Bernie said, now, I could take you into that party, but you're not ready.
Oh, my God.
And he drove us away.
Oh, my God. So that was the carrot.
Whose party was it?
I have no idea.
He was dangling that carrot, you know,
well, he's saying,
of aspiration.
His catchphrase was, you haven't said one thing that's original. What are you about? And we go, and we used to call it the riddle. And he'd say, do you know what you're about yet? And we go, what does he mean? We're a rock band. We just want to write songs. No, but what are you about? Yeah. And that's why he would give us books on art, because those books explained that you would understand that artists, when they're special, are about something.
Who was he inspired by? Was it Lou Golden, Pete Meaden? Was it
all of those people? But remember him and Malcolm, didn't they go to the LSE? And they went to art college. So they came from a very art background, which I knew nothing about. But obviously once I'd done Bernie's reading lists and I'd been for all the things to the library and read all the things, I started to understand what he meant was you need to write songs that other people aren't writing. You need to understand how your group fits into the world. What are you about?
Yeah.
So, you know, punk rock suddenly was very clear what it was about.
Was he inspiring Malcolm, do you think?
I think Malcolm and Bernie would both say they totally thought of all the ideas themselves. Yeah. So I think that's an argument between those two.
It became a thing with Bernie, didn't it? Trying to kind of be Malcolm, wasn't it?
Sitting in a restaurant with Malcolm and Bernie, and Malcolm literally saying, this is what we're going to do with the Pistols, and we're going to do this and this, and it's going to be the biggest thing. And it's like the ghastly story unfolded.
So where does Billy come into this in the beginning of your next generation, if you like?
London SS, it's sort of not really happening. We haven't done a gig. We can't find a singer. I think there was Bernie thinks I'm too middle class to be in a punk rock band, or his version of things, so that I'm getting a lot of antagonism from Bernie. We're all still scanning the adverts in the music papers. And there was an advert in the music papers looking for guitarists and bass players that John Cravin, who owned Acme Attractions in the King's Road, which was sort of a rival to Malcolm McLaren.
Yeah.
John Cravin, who Don Letts was the...
That's right, yeah. Don Letts was the DJ down there, wasn't he?
Was the shop assistant.
Shop assistant, yeah.
Cravin wanted to put a group together, so he ran adverts. So I answered the advert as well and turned up, and Billy also had turned up separately, though I didn't know him then, and also Marco, who went on to play with the Admiral. Yeah, and this was a group they were putting together around the singer John O'Hara, later to be called Gene October, who was the singer of Chelsea, and the group was to be called Chelsea. So meanwhile, I'd also answered another advert saying wanted guitarist into Small Faces, Beatles, Rolling Stones. And I borrowed my mother's car and driven all the way over to Bromley and to meet a boy who was at university with very ordinary hair and little glasses, who was to turn out to be Billy Idol. And the two of us got on really well and really liked each other. And also that afternoon we met, a girl came round to see Billy, who later transmuted into Susie Banshee, Susie Sue.
Love it.
And I turned up and I said, actually, I can't play guitar. I'm really a bass player. And I just brought my bass there. Meanwhile, I'd bought a Rickenbacker with my first university grant and my babysitting money and was still rehearsing in Neil's basement. while he played me tapes of Imagine one day.
Wow.
And it's extraordinary when I look back at it, all these incredible, amazing.
Yeah.
All these amazing moments. So Billy and I thought, well, maybe we should get together. And I went back a couple of weeks later and we sat in his bedroom and we wrote our first song together, which was Ready, Steady, Go.
Yeah,
and
I've got it. What?
I've got the entry in my diary. It says, went over to Billy's again, wrote a song called Ready, Steady, Go. Sounds quite
good. Because there's something quite unpunk about those lyrics, isn't there?
Yes.
Well, for a start, the fact that it's looking back, I mean, it's because I've got to say, what's I always thought was different about Generation X, because I fucking love Generation X.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, I was that bit younger. I was 14, and I thought the whole thing with punk was utter nihilism. That was the idea that you didn't read any books. You didn't, go, yes. You didn't do anything. It was like everything was rubbish. Everything. It was like it was the end of everything.
Half the truth that was that it was actually incredibly literary.
Yeah, so I know. As terms of everyone was Steve Diggle, everyone you talked to, but just think it was a slightly different. Slightly less nihilistic and slightly more glamorous view of life. Yes. It's like you were still trying to be something that you aspired to rather than just burning everything to the ground. Yeah. And the very fact that there's things like Ready, Steady, Go and even a reference to my generation with your generation, you know.
Well, I guess as well that we were going to university and Billy was at university and Billy was reading philosophy and I'm reading maths. And
if I'd known that, I probably wouldn't have left school at 16. Ruined my life.
Well, because it was great, because in those days they gave you a grant when you went. They gave you money to go. So I bought my Rickenbacker with my first grant, and I bought a 4x12 and a amp top with my second grant. So, I mean, there's loads of other stuff.
But what's interesting is that the Ready, Steady, Go gets written before the Ramones album, am I guessing? Before punk? No, it's got to be post-Ramones album. It's got that speed,
isn't it? I
think
you must have heard the Ramones.
And it mentions Kathy McGowan. Were you watching Kathy McGowan? I'm too young for Ready, Steady, Go. I guess were you and Billy, or was that real in your life?
Yeah, because we'd watched Ready, Steady, Go on the television when we used to come home on a Friday night.
So it was important to you. It was nostalgic for you as well.
Yeah. But it's also the fact that you're saying you love something, whereas the whole thing would have been just, I hate Top of the Pops.
No, that's right. It was meant to be a positive thing. Yeah. But we weren't that aware of all the other groups. So anyway, Billy and I end up being in Chelsea, Billy playing guitar and me playing bass, and a guy called John Tao brought in as the drummer, and Gene October as the singer. And we played two or three gigs around the Chelsea. We played at the Chelsea Potter, was our sort of local pub, which was a few doors down from Acme Attractions. And so we played in the Chelsea Potter, and we had this other guitarist that, and the entry in my diary says, we've got to get rid of the other guitarist, which we did. Obviously, really, you know, you're so cruel when you're young. You don't think he's probably really, this big moment.
And who's that? It was probably Keith Levine or someone really important.
That's right. So then we did gigs with Chelsea, and we played at the ICA on that, I think it was called the exhibition or something, with the people that turned out to be Throbbing Gristle later on. Meanwhile, then Chelsea is rehearsing in John Cravine's office, which is in Portobello Road. So Billy and I are playing with things. But it turns out Billy and I are writing the songs and not with Gene October. He's not writing the lyrics to the songs.
So is Gene gets pissed off.
Only less articulate than I might have written it, I think.
Gene gets pissed off and wants to leave. Is that what happens?
No. What happens is we're playing gigs, and we played at the ICA, and there are photos of Billy on guitar and Gene singing. It's sort of going okay, but we play at the Nashville of all places. Yeah. And what's extraordinary is I have a tape of this gig. We're doing songs mainly by me and Billy. And that afternoon, we'd written a new song called Prove It, which is on the first Gen X album. And we came on to do the encore, and the gall of it, we went to Gene October. Actually, we're going to go on and Billy's going to sing this one. So why don't you not come on for the moment and let us do this new song with Billy singing? So we came on and did the track with Billy singing. And that's when Billy and I decided to say it's not working with Gene. You know, good that he is, and he does, you know, really good stuff and everything, but it's not for us because we're writing the songs.
And also, and actually, Billy was more glam.
Billy should be the thing.
And the Pistols are still going now, aren't they? You know about that.
Pistols are going, Clash are going, Ramones are going. This is, it's in my diary, it's either the winter of 76 or the winter of 75.
Because isn't there, there's the Ramones gig at the Roundhouse, isn't there?
Which we all go to.
Yeah.
And everyone who's in any punk group was at that gig. We need a lead guitarist because Billy's going to be the singer. And we're back to that thing. Where the fuck are we going to find a guitarist who's going to be right for the group? But, you know, somehow when there's the planets aligned and it's meant to be, it happens. So a week into us looking for a guitarist or thinking about who the hell could we get, Billy goes to a party in Fulham and there's this little schoolboy group playing and the guitarist is Durwood. And Billy phones me from the call box and I've got it in my diary that says Billy phones up. Billy goes, all excited. I've seen the bloke. He's going to be great. He's got long hair. He'll have to cut it, but he plays great. And Durwood literally came down to rehearsals a week later. And within 2 weeks, we were playing gigs with Durwood as the lead guitarist.
And Durwood's 17 at that time, isn't he?
He's like 16 and 17. Oh, wow. And he cuts his hair the night before we play our first gig. And he looks like a perfectly young Jeff Beck.
He was a great player too. He is a great player. Where did you have the name Generation X at that point? Or you?
We got that from in Billy's bookcase at home. And I was rummaging through the books and he had the book Generation X and I pulled it out.
There it is. Is it that one?
Oh, wow. Yes, that's the one.
That's the
and
one.
Then, so you must have been, I remember years they'd been shocked going into Book Soup and going, oh, wow, have they reissued it or something? And buying Generation X by Douglas Copeland.
Yeah. Oh, yes. No,
which then ends up being the entire name of the generation. Movement.
That's right. That's right. And,
different. Generation X has been completely usurped. And
That is that early book, isn't it? That was a sociopolitical book by Charles Hamblett and Jane Deverson. I love this bit. Let me read this, guys. So it's got, what's behind the rebellious anger of Britain's untamed youth, Generation X? Here, in their own words, is how they really feel about drugs, drink, God, sex, class, colour and kicks. And then on the black, it's got a quote. I feel right proud of myself when I can bash someone in.
That's right. We'll quote that.
Tony James, I read loads of books and go to university.
At the end of Youth on the recording, you can hear us quoting that quote.
Oh, really?
I bash someone in at the end of the track on the record.
Yeah. So Generation X and that is boomers, right?
Yes, we were a much more positive thing. We were more like... that we were like Who Live at Leeds, Generation X. It was a really explosive group live because Durwood was such a brilliant guitarist. Mm. And then once we got Mark Laffin, who played like Keith Moon, we moved into total Live at Leeds type shows. And that's what we did. And we even covered Led Zeppelin's Rock and Roll when we used to play with
So Tony, this
risky,
is
risky,
this,
risky.
This is the bit everyone waits for in the show, obviously, because this is where I come in to the stage. Yeah. But no, just basically when I first saw you, that was at the Hope and Anchor and it's sort of December 76. So how early in was that to your career?
Must have been really, really early.
And I remember you did a short set with lots of encores.
Yes.
And then I remember you saying
the dogs barking.
That you didn't say that from the stage. No, what you said from the stage was we've run out of songs or something like that. I remember that happening.
Yes.
I became obsessed with you guys, loved you, and saw you used to go to the place called the Vortex, which used to be the Crackers Club on Wardour Street.
And we were the first group to play the Roxy. We played it, I think, on December the 12th or something. There's that great poster of me and Billy that I made up out sort of cut-ups out from the Evening Standard, and we Xeroxed it.
Because Roxy was Andy Czazowski. Is it Czazowski? Czazowski, how it pronounces his name.
Actually, the person who found the Roxy Club, I have to give him credit, was Gene October. Oh. It was called Shagaramas before, and it was a kind of a gay club, and he knew of it. And that's how we ended up getting to play at what became the Roxy Club.
We supported Chelsea in the early Spandau Ballet called The Makers. Wow. We supported Chelsea at the Roxy. Anyway, we loved you as our band, The Makers, and we all went to school and we made our own pop art T-shirts to wear in a photograph. That photograph is out there on the internet somewhere. But we screen printed because we were copying what you were doing. You were wearing these pop art T-shirts.
Well, Billy made those very block color type t-shirts.
Mondriani type things.
Yes, exactly. And whereas I did the ones that were paintings because I was good at art. You know, I did an Iggy Pop one because you couldn't buy an Iggy Pop t-shirt in those days. So I painted my own Iggy Pop from a photograph. I transferred the photograph to a t-shirt by painting on the t-shirt. You could never wash them. And that. I wish I still had them. My mother gave them all to the charity shop when she was clearing out the loft.
But I'd like to say that also your art style, when that first single came out, there was a sense of references of, I think it was the first time I'd seen Russian constructivism inside any pop group's art, which obviously became such a big thing in the early 80s and the Face magazine.
Yeah, it was.
Whose idea was that? Where did that
come from? Barney Bubbles did the sleeve. He came up with the 45 on the front of dub mixes when they had 12-inch dub mixes. So I had a T-shirt with 45, and I think he took that 45 but used that quite iconic 45 Generation X, Your Generation T.
I'd like to also thank Tony for one other influence on my career, because when Wild Youth came out, the B-side was Wild Dub. And I loved the way you know, this is the first time a non sort of black band had done anything like that and broken down the track into dub. And it stayed with me that. So when we did To Cut Long Story Short, you know, 4 years, 3 years later or whatever it was, funnily enough, on the same record label, Chrysalis, I said, can we do a dub version of this? And we did a 12-inch single of To Cut Long Story Short mix like that. And that was really because of you.
Right. Well, because we were so influenced by Vivian Goldman, who we hung out with, who took us to see all the... And of course, punk was very much because of Don Letts, who we were friends with, because of Acme Attractions, who was then the DJ at the Roxy Club with Leo. We were listening to... Because there were no punk records to play. They would play dub reggae.
Well, also, you needed something slightly chilled to listen to at some point.
Yeah. So it became a massive, massive influence. That record was produced by Phil Wayman. We got Phil Wayman, who was the producer of The Suite, because we liked Ballroom Blitz. And he produced our first two or three records. He was totally freaked out at the idea of doing a dub version. And I think he sort of ended up doing it with the engineer. And we were going, no, put echo on this. And can you do that? And can you stop the, you know, cutting it all to pieces? It was really kind of experimental, because obviously a rock track is really fast. It's hard to get the dub effects to sit with the rock beat. So you had to half time the drums and everything. But there was a very experimental, but the first of its kind, a rock and roll dub.
But there was a sense that you were the pop stars, if you like, of the punk movement, Generation X. You had exactly. Pop sensibility. It was glam rock was definitely your influence.
Well, because Billy had changed his hair, because one day he came in, because I knew him as Billy all the time, and then one day in because he still had blonde hair but just sort of swept over to one side. He didn't have the spikes. It was only early on in Gen X where he turned up one day and went, I'm going to be Billy Idol. And he'd spiked all his hair up. And we went, wow, you know. And that's when I first sort of looked at him, because he always looked quite nerdy when we first met, because he had little glasses and he had sort of long
hair. I've seen the photograph.
And it was like a sort of phoenix rising. And it was like, fuck, you know, this like monster grew out of the nerdy bloke who was doing philosophy at university.
But what's funny, talking about seeing as you are so much about sort of the conceptual side of things and the ideas and everything, and you got Billy Idol, and then you were talking about Ratscapers and stuff. Did you never want to have a name, Tony? A sort of
no.
Nom de guerre.
I did flirt with the idea of calling myself Tony Rome in the early days, but after the movie. Isn't it a Frank Sinatra movie? It's like sort of a caper movie in the south of France. But it just seems silly, and that's why I just stayed with my real name.
Yeah, so. I mean, what was the feeling within Generation X? Did you feel that you were getting somewhere with this project, or did it feel like you always had your feet slightly in some mud and being held back? I mean, I know, you know, I love that first album with that Martin Rushent produced. I absolutely Kiss Me Deadly and all of those tracks,
which we recorded over 2 days in TW Studios in the Fulham Palace Road. Which was perfect for me because I was living at my grandmother's house, who lived just by Fulham Football Ground, just off the Fulham Palace Road. So I'd sort of, when I left home from Twickenham, I lived with my grandmother.
Because the thing is, I feel, always felt that you were slightly ahead of your time, really. That, you know, there were a lot of punks were sort of clambering to get on top. You had something that actually would have succeeded more in the 80s. And, of course, Billy did succeed in the 80s.
Yes. Well, it was conceptually a great-looking group. I always had this kind of thing that everyone had to be the same height and thin and have the right hair and, you know...
Yeah, like the Beatles.
Madness. I always was never sure about the original drummer, even though Rob Tyner in the MC5 had curly hair. I never wanted to have a singer with curly hair, although it worked with Mark Bolan. But I had this kind of vision of how the group should look, and it sort of gradually came together.
Did when you literally fail people the audition on their height?
Height, size, trousers, anything really.
It was like a police lineup. No, too short.
Yeah. But that's that thing of youth, isn't it? That you have this kind of vision of how you want it to be.
Yeah.
And obviously I took that to a stage much further, having spent all that time with Malcolm and having been through punk when, you know, we eventually moved on to Zig Zig Sputnik.
But Bernie was your teacher, you know, in a way.
Bernie had taught me so well, and Malcolm, and the Pistols thing was so brilliantly orchestrated, and the quotes and the playing in obscure clubs, which you did with Spandau when you played on the
Battleship.
That's
right. We were inspired by you guys, yeah.
I went to all the first Spandau gigs. You know, I went to the one in Birmingham. Didn't you do one in...
Yeah, we did. I was surprised for you to tell me that. I mean, that's amazing. I didn't know you'd gone up to the one in Birmingham.
Yeah, I came up in a coach with people.
Oh, you were up with all that, with Chris Sullivan and Christos and everybody. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
God, how easily we forget.
The conceptual ideas were very much from Malcolm and Bernie.
They were. Yeah. I wanted to just ask you about, because you did Generation X went on Mark's show, didn't you? You did Mark Bolan's show.
We did. Yes, we did.
What was that like? What was that like?
Great. And he was really sweet to us. And in fact, he gave Durwood his Les Paul.
What? What made him do that?
I don't know. And then we got banned from Granada TV because Mark Laff stole the drum kit or something. And Bowie was on that show as well.
Oh, it was that one.
Oh, it was a week. That's a week before Mark dies.
Yeah. That's right. That was the first time we'd ever seen ourselves. And I can remember all racing back to see it on the television because you had to watch it.
And did you talk to David?
I think we sort of wafted past his aura.
because it's such a sad show, because Mark didn't want to, you know, Mark asked to play with David on Heroes and David said no. So Mark gets very drunk off of the wine he'd gifted to David.
Falls off the stage, doesn't he?
Falls off the stage at the end, and that's the last he was ever on TV.
He's just gone to play bass, I think, on that one. So, you know, Generation X was conceptually great. It was so exciting live. I think we went off the rails a bit on the second album where it got too grandiose. It was a sort of our reaction against Rama Lama 3-minute, you know, fast punk songs. I was listening to too much Live at Leeds or too much Bruce Springsteen, looking for different influences. And that second album, although some of the songs are really good.
They're really good. What I really liked was it was really like really nice, clever riffs on things.
Yes.
That's the thing I liked.
Yeah. Well, which Billy is fantastic at writing. Mm.
So did Billy do the music?
Yes, Billy did the music. Well, Billy would come in with the initial chords and the tune, and I always came up with the titles and the lyrics. I type the lyrics on my mum's old typewriter and give them to Billy, and then he would put the tune together. So yes, it was the other way around, that Billy wrote the tunes and I wrote the lyrics.
You were his Bernie.
Bernie Taupin. Yes.
You actually did write Dancing with Myself, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right.
That started off as a Gen X song.
That's right. And what happened with that song is we're on one of the last tours of the original lineup with Durwood. We toured in Japan, and it was extraordinary playing Japan. Really huge gigs, and people went really bonkers seeing us. And we were in the nightclub, Billy and I, and there was the kids in the nightclub were dancing with their reflections in the mirror. The nightclub had all mirrors for walls. And we were watching, and I went, look, he's dancing with himself. And I went, you know what, Billy, that'd be a great, great title for a song, Dancing with Myself. And I went home and I wrote the first three or four lines on, you know, like on the back of a crisp packet type thing. you know, with the mirror's reflection, I'm dancing with myself. And I gave Billy the first initial few sets of lyrics, and we didn't think anything out more out of it. And we were recording the Generation X third album in Olympic Studios in Barnes. And Billy came in really late that morning. He'd met some girl, obviously, which he did every night. And he went, "Here, Tone, you know that dance myself? I think I've got a bit of a tune for it." And we went and sat on the back stairs, Olympic Studios, with an acoustic guitar, just me and Billy. And he sang the E-A-B-A, you know, oh, I'm dancing with myself. And we literally wrote all the lyrics while we sat on the stairs in that moment.
The funny thing is, of course, it always ends up on any of those lists of great wanking songs.
Which it wasn't at all. Exactly. What it does do is that song works brilliantly because it's such positive energy. Mm-hmm. You just have to hear the drum beat, you feel good. And the guitar bit comes on. And the guitar bit was very much, we wanted Durwood to play. Billy and I both love Public Image, Lydon's track. You know, with Public Image.
One of the great riffs. Yeah.
That's
and one of the great bass riffs as well.
So we said, and of course, my bass on Dance Myself is very like the bass on Public Image. And then we said to Durwood, well, play the tune, na 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 na, on the guitar, high on the strings, just like in the style of Keith Levine. So that's how we recorded a demo of it that afternoon.
And who was managing you at that point? Is this when you had Bill O'Coin? So you got your American manager who was going to end up managing Billy, right?
That's right. Well, it was my idea, of course, that we'd got rid of the original managers, Stuart Joseph and what was his name? The journalist who managed Generation X for the first few years, but who really, for me, didn't have creative input and were also... what it seemed to us, making all the money. When we signed our record deal, they gave me and Billy a fiver each and went, why don't you go and buy something to eat? And off we toddled. Meanwhile, we'd got out of the deal. We had to pay a load of money to them to get out of the management contract. It was John Ingham was the other manager.
Oh, right.
We paid a load of money, which sat on the unrecouped position of Generation X for about 15 or 20 years. And I had a meeting with Chrysalis, with Chris Wright and Terry Ellis. And I said, why don't we get that bloke who manages Kiss? Because he understands the television age. And they flew me and Billy out to New York to meet Bill O'Coin. But we met Bill O'Coin and I thought, really, really liked him.
Yeah.
So he started to manage the group. And as soon as he heard Dancing With Myself, he said, that's a hit. And it was his idea to get Keith Forsey to produce the record. Because Keith Forsey had been Giorgio Moroder's drummer. Moroder's records. Bill O'Coin thought Dancing Myself was a huge hit. And so we made it with Keith Forsey as producer.
Wow.
Meanwhile, we were trying to find Durwood and Mark Lafford left the band, even though they were brilliant players and we loved it. And they still go, oh, you never did our songs. And I would still say to them, never once did you ever walk in the studio and go, Billy, Tone, listen to this, fancy doing this song. Never once. You know, I would have really been happy if Durwood had been George Harrison and said, I've got this great one, Here Comes the Sun. What about this? We would have fallen on it. So they'd left the band and we were looking for a guitarist. Well, our first choice was Steve New, the Mercurial guitarist.
Oh, yes.
Rich Kids.
Yeah, Rich Kids, yeah.
Who was fantastic. And we did loads of rehearsing with him. And I've got loads of tapes with Steve, and his playing was absolutely
inspired. Brilliant, Steve, wasn't he?
Amazing.
Brilliant, totally out there.
But the only thing is,
unfortunately, and most of the tapes, you can hear me going, okay, let's do Dancing Myself then, Steve. And Steve would go, how's it go? And I go, Steve, we did it yesterday. What chord is it? Yeah. So he'd totally forgotten. But I got fantastic recordings of Steve and Billy and me playing, and we got Terry Chimes as the drummer.
But what put Dancing Myself in Billy's hands as opposed to in Generation X's hands in the end?
So we recorded it, and it was a great track. We put it out, but it did nothing. Meanwhile, Billy won't be upset about me talking about this because we've both talked about it honestly since we've met again now and become, you know, good friends again. Billy had become, had started going out with one of the girls in Hot Gossip, which was at that time, Hot Gossip were the sort of sexiest thing on television. I was trying to go out with the other one in the group. And Billy was going out with her. And Billy had meanwhile started to get into heroin. And that's something that was a huge shock, because when we first started with Generation X, Billy was a total vegan. We used to go to gigs and Billy used to bring a little saucepan full of brown rice and brew it up in the dressing room with some vegetables. And he wouldn't eat hamburgers for, you know, the greasy stops at the Watford Gap or anything. He'd have his own little thing. Get to the three albums in, Billy starts to do heroin, and that totally changes your relationship.
Yeah.
Although ironically, by then I was living with my then girlfriend, Magenta, who was a heroin addict. I didn't know when I first started going out with her. I remember on our first date, she put a handbag on the bar and this huge bottle, brown bottle, rolled out of her handbag across the bar. And I went, bloody hell, what's that? And she went, oh, it's just my methadone. And I didn't even know what methadone was. So Billy was getting into heroin, and that really changed our relationship, and that we were no longer sort of hanging out together. Yeah. And so it's really why the group split up, because, oh, and Billicoin wanted us to move to America. And I didn't want to go to America. I was still quite scared of the idea of moving to America, whereas Billy was quite proofed from the fear of that. So Billy just moved to America and Billicoin was there. And he took the track Dancing With Myself and put it on his records. I didn't even know you couldn't do that. You know, I went into Chrysalis one day and I went, oh, you know, we're in the studio next week. And they went, no, Billy's in America. And I went, is he? Oh, fuck. Better come up with something else then. And I can remember walking away from Chrysalis Records in Stratford Place thinking, bloody hell, now what am I going to do? I'm going to have to start all over again.
Do you know what, Tony? I think this is a perfect EastEnders drum beat moment.
Because then we go on to you sitting in the cafe in Mayfair for a couple of
minutes. That's right. The whole Sputnik story, which of course, Sputnik story playing with Johnny Thunders.
We're going to get on to this.
Can you imagine? I'm in a group with three heroin addicts and my girlfriend's a heroin addict and I never taken heroin and I never have.
Can you come back and do a part two?
Yeah,
Tony? Very soon.
It's an interesting story, obviously. And
it's a great story.
The Sputnik story is my grand movie. This is my apocalypse now. You know, it's the conceptual idea taken to the nth degree, and it goes all the way to number one.
Oh, we're going to look forward to this.
Dream guest time.
Can you and Ben make an arrangement with us?
Sure.
And we'll get you on for a part two. We might even put out as a midweek immediately after this one goes out. Who knows?
Look, it's lovely to speak to you both.
So Tony is the epitome of raconteurs. This is why we have to make a part two out of this. I had no idea.
Have to make a part two. I mean, it's even that we could have just kept going.
But it's great storyteller, fantastic storyteller, and a nice and an interesting person, and to you know, and great success at the end of one's career, most success he's ever had.
I mean, if there was ever an example of you know, never give up on your dreams, kids,
here is it. Great to see you. So we will be catching up with Tony again. I don't know when that episode's going to come out, but it will. And we're doing some live stuff, aren't we?
We're going to be at Battersea Power Station on February the 22nd for our Quadrophenia extravaganza, which we cannot wait to do with Phil Daniels and Frank Rodham.
And the whole movie.
Just go to thepowerstation.com. You can find, you know, Battersea Power Station. There'll be a website. It'll tell you.
Yes. So we'll see you there. It's a good night from me.
And it's a good night from them.
Raconteurs is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part?
They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.